This is Thursday, October 14. Is that right? We're still in chapter 10. Slide number five. I'm going to pop this open. It's going to yak at me. No, it didn't. It's amazing. And we're going to see what's going on here. So we have this mechanical sensitive channel, which I described to you earlier. Again, a marvelous thing. I mean, how do you know you touch something? How do you know you touch something? I mean, how does your brain? You close your eyes. How do you know you're touching something? Just pressure. It's just pressure. And yet the sense of touching, it is an electrical response. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. Ligand-gated, that means you have some compound comes along, attaches to the receptor, it opens up, neurotransmitters, hormones, signal-gating channels, cyclic-amine, calcium ion. Calcium ion, of course, you see, is a second messenger. It's relatively low concentration within the cell. So if calcium is allowed into the cell or is released from a storage place within the cell, into the cytoplasm, it can act as a second messenger. Voltage-gated channels, of course, that is dealing with the action potential for nerves. We're going to look at that in some detail here. For most of you have seen this before. This is going to be a review, not in too much detail, but it is important. When we get into second semester, we'll be dealing with that with a greater level of detail. You can see here that the resting potential is typically negative 60 millivolts. That means outside versus inside. The inside is 60 millivolts more negative. You got the equilibrium potential for potassium is down here. Sodium's up here. So sodium actually has a voltage of plus 60, and potassium is about minus 75 or so. And so what happens is the initial action potential, there is a voltage-gated channel that opens up, and it must be a sodium channel, because as that channel opens and sodium is allowed to move in, it approaches the equilibrium voltage for sodium. Eventually, that change in voltage also initiates a potassium channel opening, and the potassium begins to be allowed to be a flow. Let's see here, out of the cell, and thus it begins to bring it back down here, and sometimes it shoots past that, and you get what's known as hyperpolarization, and typically the depolarization with this is in the range from 0 to 60. And you can see this is happening in the same time frame as sodium permeability and potassium permeability. There's a sodium channel that opens briefly and locks shut, and then a potassium channel that opens and then closes over time. And this occurs within 1 or 2 milliseconds. So, I mean, this is very important because this is occurring for your hearing as well because, I mean, as soon as I say it, you don't have to wait 3 or 4 or 5 milliseconds before you notice I'm saying something. The change is very, very quick. This is, of course, some would claim for just sheer survivability of the species, but it is what it is. So here you got the resting state. The resting state is not shown here, but I mean the pump is not shown here. There's sodium potassium ATPase that's pumping out sodium and pumping in potassium, and so you've got a situation there that where these two gates that are responsible for these two poor differential permeabilities, they're closed. A voltage comes in, the sodium then begins to rush into the cell. And thus, the cell becomes depolarized, moving toward a positive charge. The potassium gate still closed. There is a timing system that closes this, the sodium gate, and then begins to open the potassium gate, allowing potassium out of the cell. It moves then, that potassium permeability then causes the action potential to begin to move toward the potassium equilibrium, so the charge becomes more negative now. And eventually, that overshoots a little bit. That gate doesn't close appropriately, and so it stays open a little longer than it should. Notice that long, gradual change, and so you get a slight hyperpolarization, but eventually it shuts too. And when it shuts, it's ready for another nerve impulse. So this nerve impulse, the total span of time that action potential occurs is 1 to 2 milliseconds, and immediately that same region can respond to another action potential. And you can see here, this diagram is very similar to this one that's in the text. So there are these voltage-gated channels which are crucial to us being alive and being sensitive to our environment. Very, very quick, very important. All right, so now then, so you've got these things. Some transport proteins typically use conformational changes to move substances. This is the enzyme called GLUT1. GLUT1. And why am I not actually moving through this in a, you know, line by line pattern? I don't know. I don't have time to change it. But anyway, so for those of you who have glucose in your bloodstream or don't have glucose in your bloodstream, your liver acts as a glucose buffer. Your liver especially acts as a glucose buffer. Significant amounts of glycogen are held there in storage over a 24-hour period typically. And so each of the liver cells that stores glycogen has this GLUT1 transporter in it. Various levels of GLUT1 transporter exist. In other words, based on your hormonal situation, you can have more or fewer GLUT proteins, GLUT transporters in the membrane surface, in the plasma membrane. For the GLUT1, this is a mediated transport that's purely passive. Yes. Right.
Is it always coming in
the... Yep. Only in the cyclic. Yep. The transporters only bind cyclic or cyclic. That's correct. Doesn't bind the linear. Yep. Which is okay because 99.5% of the glucose in your bloodstream is cyclic. Yeah. So you get this GLUT transporter sitting on the surface. There are, if you would draw a liver cell, it appears, at least. So the GLUT1 is sitting right here. There's more than one copy in each of the cells. There appears to be, and I'm not sure they know where, but the people who study this stuff do, probably around the ER, there are kind of like unused, stored GLUT1 transporters that are in the interior of the cell waiting for signals to move either toward the interior to the exterior, or sometimes a signaling moves these to reduce the number on the surface of the cell. That signaling may be related to insulin and glucagon levels. Now, so you've got this transporter that's here, and simply based on the concentration, if it's a higher concentration on the outside of the cell, it will bind to that opening there, move it across, release it, and then conform itself to make it available again, and then the glucose is simply transported in based on concentration gradients. If you have a situation where you've not eaten, if there's no food in your gut, as it were, and you need glucose for your brain, then the glycogen that's here, the glycogen molecules that are here, is being broken down and releasing glucose 6-phosphate, which is then broken down by glucose 6-phosphatase into glucose. And then the glucose then would simply have a higher concentration in the interior than the exterior and simply would be diffused out through that transporter. Without that transporter, glucose has a very hard time getting through the membrane because it's so polar. So that's one model of how transport occurs. And again, since this is this would be a mediated but not an active transport. This would simply be a passive mediated transport because no energy is required. Simply changes in the glucose. Active transport, pumping substances against the concentration gradient, typically coupled to ATP hydrolysis in some form. There's a P-type ATPase pump. Actually, the pump itself gets phosphorylated, phosphorylates the ATP. F-type, this is a proton transporting in the mitochondria bacterial membranes. This one creates ATP from the proton gradient. So the F-type produces ATP from a gradient. This is the V-type, like F-type, but it's in plant vacuoles and acidic vesicles. And A-type transport ions across anions across membranes. Then you have these ABC transporters. Transports lots of substances. It's a very naughty transporter because it infers drug resistance to bacteria. So if you have a an enzyme or a target in the interior of a bacterium that you're targeting with an antibiotic, you've got to figure out somehow over generations of exposures, these bacteria will learn how to pump it out. And many times, there are actually antibiotics that have a secondary compound that's designed to inhibit the pumping of the antibiotic out of the cell. So the bacteria are extremely sophisticated. They're very stupid individually, but collectively they're very, very smart. And so you're fighting, almost fighting losing battle. I would suspect that within our lifetime, my lifetime at least, we're going to have at least one or two bacterial outbreaks in which there are no antibiotics that can deal with it. None. And so, yikes. All right. Here's the sodium potassium ATPase. They figure about 20% of the energy in your body is used simply to pump that sodium, is for that sodium potassium ATPase. It creates low sodium inside the cells and high potassium outside of it. It prevents osmosis from destroying the cell. It's critical. Up to 70% of the ATP, some nerve cells, are used to power this enzyme. And I'm not going to ask you to memorize this model for it, but it's interesting nevertheless. You've got the E1, the enzyme in the first state, binds three sodiums. Magnesium comes in, ATP comes in, and you've got this enzyme that's a complex of the enzyme ATP and the three sodiums. That potassium is then attached to the enzyme, and then sodium is still there. There is a movement, a physical conformation that moves that enzyme into the moves the sodium inside the cell. The phosphate's still there. Then potassium bind to it. You've got the potassium. There's a phosphate hydrolysis, which is an energy releasing process. That enzyme then moves back, changes conformation, takes the potassium out, and it loses the potassium and gains the sodium, and you start the whole process all over again. So there's an intimate requirement for that ATP to be there and to hydrolyze it, both in the cell and outside. There's hydrolysis outside the cell and inside the cell, and that's very important for moving those potassiums in, out, and the sodium. Oh, yeah, sodium's out and potassium's in. All right, notice where the outside and the inside is. All right, so the ATP would have to come inside the cell. Active transport and ion gradients. For example, this is another variation of this. You're going to need to read the text. I'm just hitting the highlights here. But lactose permease co-transports lactose and hydrogen ion. So this is potentially occurs in bacteria, where you've got lactose on the outside. There it is, binding to it. So you've got that proton binding to the enzyme in that particular conformation. The hydrogen ion is brought in along with the lactose. And then the lactose is released. The hydrogen is released. And oxidative metabolism then pumps that hydrogen back out again. So if you're familiar with the electron transport system, you're familiar with that? Pumps protons in the intermembrane region. Protons then move through the sodium potassium, through that ATP synthase, makes ATP. Well, this is the bacteria cell. The bacteria do the same thing, except they pump hydrogens from the interior to the outside, which allows for a high excess of hydrogen ion in the outside, allows for an electrochemical gradient that will move lactose from low concentration to high concentration inside the cell. So the lactose, once it meets it, gets pumped into the bacteria interior through this active process using a hydrogen ion and an ion gradient. So So now we have glucose transport in the epithelial intestine. Now I have, what did I have today? Oh yeah, I had a piece of toast with peanut butter and homemade strawberry jam on it for breakfast. One. I also had a half a bar of, well, never mind, just granola bar things. All right, so plenty of carbohydrate, ladies and gentlemen, plenty of carbohydrate. So it hits my gut, and the gut then has all these intestinal folds, and the folds have silica, and the silica have cilia, or the villi have cilia. And so you've got a situation here where these folds, you notice here, have capillary beds. And also, if you notice, it's got this interior right here. That interior right there is part of the lymph glands. Lymph glands. This is a lymph gland projection that goes up into these villi. This is because the lymph glands are responsible for carrying fat from your intestinal tract through your body. Not the blood initially, but the lymph nodes. The lymph system is designed to carry fat. We'll talk about that when we get to fat metabolism. Nevertheless, what happens here is typically you'll find that glucose is at a relatively low concentration compared to the interior of the cell. You don't want glucose sitting there any length of time because the bacteria will immediately begin to rapidly metabolize it. And it does so rapidly there's not enough oxygen there. There is oxygen available, but it produces lots of carbon dioxide if it stays there, and you end up having flatulence or gas. So this glucose then has this sodium glucose symport. Symport. I need to go back to the other thing because I didn't review that. Symport. So the symport is a glucose sodium. The sodium is high concentration on the outside, low on the inside, and the protein, this transporter, binds both glucose and sodium and uses the electrochemical gradient for sodium to pull the glucose into the cell. The sodium then gets pumped through the ATPase and gets pumped back into the circulation and then goes to the, perhaps if it's an excess, goes to your urine. This is a part of the microvilli, and you have that symport. So that symport here, that glucose uniport, which is again what I just described, if there's a high concentration of glucose in the interior of the cell versus the capillaries, then it'll simply move through that uniport to the lower concentration part of the range, which in this case means the red blood cells or the circulation to the capillaries, and so it just moves right out just based on concentration gradient. But the sodium but the glucose, relatively low compared to the cell, so it has to be pumped in. That's assuming, of course, you haven't had a couple dozen of donuts, Krispy Kremes. Yes. All right. So, let's see here. All right, so we got to go back here. I want to talk about this right here. Of course, if you've got a transporter that simply goes in and out in one direction, sometimes this is actually one direction or the other depending on the concentration. If it only moves one thing, that's called a uniport. A symport uses two things in the same direction. An antiport moves two things but in opposite directions. So uniport, symport, antiport. Remember those phrases. Remember those phrases. So fascinating. You'll need to discuss this with me, especially this region right in here, the blown up area, exactly how glucose is brought into the cell or into the interior of the body. This lumen, of course, is essentially the exterior of your body, and so on. You got that. So I might ask you on a test question or something about writing a caption for that particular thing. All right, so we're done with number 10. We now have... So we finished 9 when?
Yesterday.
And we finished 10 today. This is so rude, isn't it? Yes. It's very tough. All right, well, let's take a look at this. And I want somebody to write this down and email it to me, because I'm not going to remember it. Because we are going to adjust these days. All right? So, let's make this, let's see here. The previous chapter 10 was due on, was it Tuesday? And the homework was due Wednesday, I thought. I said Wednesday. Oh, everything's due Wednesday? Homework Wednesday, quizzes Tuesday, right? Okay, now, all right, well, let's try to be fair on this one. This G-protein pathway, let's, what?
It's not online. It's just the link isn't found.
What's not found?
G-protein pathway.
It's not there? But there's a link there, but it says it can't.
But it says error page not found.
How rude. Yeah, just skip it. Yeah, well, I'll fix that link here pretty soon. So G-protein, you say, which one doesn't work? G-protein?
Yeah, G-protein.
Okay. Let's see here. I really want to be as equitable as possible. But if I push it too far, let's have this homework due on Friday. The homework due on Friday. And the quiz due on Wednesday. That's 3 days from now. That G-protein quiz is actually not that hard. There's a lot of boxes with it. So let's make that. And someone email that to me, because I will forget. But I got to get that fixed. Glossary quiz and summary quiz, again, just see the list. Very simple, very straightforward on that stuff. I don't think we have chapter 10 of these things done today, so don't rush up there today to do it. We're running behind a little bit on the quizzes. I'm sure you don't mind. All right, so that's chapter 10, ladies and gentlemen. We're running out of the G-protein is over halfway on these things, so it's okay. We're getting there, slowly but surely. So those of you who should have chapter 11, you should have chapter 11 available to you.
Can you post chapter 11 as a PowerPoint, not just a PDF?
Did I post it as a PDF? I've always posted it as a PowerPoint before, haven't I? That's because I've lost my mind. Okay. Yes, I'll post it. Absolutely. Thought for the day. Jesus looked up to her and said, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and do not sin again." All right? It's not God that condemns us. It's not Jesus that condemns us. We condemn ourselves when we look, when we compare ourselves to the Ten Commandments. But God came to save us, not to condemn us. All right. Let's go ahead here. Chapter 11. This is now a whole new ball game, ladies and gentlemen. You're going to need to pull out that trusty calculator and wipe it off, get it all dusty, and put in fresh batteries. Because we're going to do a little bit of algebra for this. A little bit of actually arithmetic for some of this. Now, so this is now enzymes. We would not exist without enzymes. That's it. I mean, the fact that we exist at all in our particular form is just amazing, mind-boggling. But nevertheless, catalysis, I mean, enzymes really are what make us happen. Everything else is just too slow. So we're going to take a look at how catalysis operates. We're going to take a look at catalytic mechanisms, specific examples of catalysis, zymogens, and enzymes in clinical diagnosis. So, overview of enzymes. Why are enzymes so effective? First of all, they have high reaction rates. High reaction rates. They're basically, biological catalysts, ladies and gentlemen. Mild reaction conditions. When we get to fatty acids, you've run across my favorite enzyme. It's in the beta oxidation of fatty acids. It was called acyl-CoA dehydrogenase, I think. And it took, and I'll show it to you again, but it took a single bond and in a single step removed two hydrogens and their electrons to make a double bond. Now, I have to understand, if you remember from organic chemistry, how many reactions were there in a single step that went from a single bond to a double bond? How many one-step reactions were there? There may have been high temperature will do it for like ethane and propane. That's true. But in terms of a named reaction, there isn't any. There just isn't, that I know of. But notice this will happen in an aqueous solution at 37 degrees and 1 atmosphere pressure. Will go from a single bond to a double bond in a single step. That's why it's my favorite enzyme. Anyway, reaction specificity. You can have hundreds, perhaps thousands of differing molecules and proteins in your cell, and a particular enzyme will find that one particular substrate that it will act upon and ignore all the others. And lastly, it can be regulated. I cannot emphasize anymore what that means. Life is regulation. Life is regulation. All these pathways that I've asked you to memorize, I asked you to memorize them because we're not going to necessarily go over the pathways in detail. We're going to go over their regulation. And in order to know what you're regulating, you have to know the pathway. So it's the regulation of these things that is crucial and marvelous and exquisite. All right. Oh, let me go back. Let's take a look here. Anyway, look at the accelerations that occur. Carbonic anhydrase. What does carbonic anhydrase do? Do you remember? Carbonic anhydrase? Yeah, it takes carbon dioxide and water and makes it into carbonic acid, which then spontaneously breaks down into hydrogen and bicarbonate. That's exactly right. Non-spontaneous here is 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 6. That's almost 10 million times faster. And here you have this one I like down here, this staphylococcal nuclease. Of course, the DNA simply does not hydrolyze on its own. It's very stable. Do you want DNA to be very stable? Yes, so that's why the rate here is so low. It seems like 95, in other words, it acts on 95 residues every second. Wow, that's pretty slow. But compared to what the non-enzymatic is, that's a 10 to the 14th acceleration. Unbelievable, ladies and gentlemen. Absolutely fantastic amount of acceleration. And we're completely dependent on that. Carboxypeptidase A, 10 to the 11th. You're using that right now. Triosphosphatase somerase, 10 to the 9th. You're using that right now, ladies and gentlemen. Right now you're using it. Even as we speak. Enzyme classifications. Oxidoreductases, guess what they deal with? Transferases, guess what they deal with? Hydrolases, guess what they deal with? And lyases. Now, lyases is a little different term. That's going to be the one you might have to memorize. You're going to be responsible for this list, but the lyase is you eliminate something to form a double bond. That's what isomerase, isomerization, ligases. Of course, ligases, you bring things together. Ligases, you ligand them together. You bring them together. Bond formation with ATP hydrolysis. Substrate specificity. One of the beautiful things about enzymes is that they are so specific to a particular substrate. How do they do that? Well, they're stereospecific. Stereospecific. So what that means is really very straightforwardly, I'm looking for somebody who has a free right hand. Aaron, how you doing? Great. Exactly. Notice, what are we doing here? This is classic stereospecificity, okay? So shake hands. No, try my left. Ah, that doesn't work so well, does it? No. And what's the difference between my two hands? Huh? What's the only difference between my two hands? Orientation in three-dimensional space. That's it. And yet, shake hands or not. Okay? And I'm just being trivial about it. All right, now, that's stereospecificity. Enzymes are handed. The materials they interact with are handed. But there's even greater level of specificity. This is called geometric specificity. It's a more rigorous requirement. It includes it, but it's more rigorous. It includes 3D information, polar, nonpolar, ionic, size, and shape information. Someone here. It's a fascinating thing here. All right, so, and I just stepped on my... if I may continue to use your right hand there. All right, so what that means is, literally, if I put... So now she has, her enzyme has a particular kind of, it's not only stereospecificity, but it may be a negative charge here. All right, a negative charge. And does anybody have another cap? Here's another cap that's a negative charge. So even though we might fit handedly, because that substrate in there is a negative charge and this is a negative charge, we're not going to fit well. So that's another level. See, ionic size and shape information. However, if there's a complementariness to it, in other words, this substrate and this enzyme now is both shaped correctly and in that active side where it binds, there is a complementariness, as it were, to the charges or other things, then it fits. So notice that geometric specificity has a higher level of specification than does just mere geometry. Thank you very much. That's the idea. The binding sites have aspects to it. So here is a drawing of that. You can see here where you've got hydrophobic interactions. You've got a negative charge, a hydrophobic interaction. You've got a polar group right here. You've got oxygen, perhaps. As it fits into the enzyme binding site would probably have hydrogen ions there. Hydrophobic interactions, a hydrogen bond. Some sort of salt bridge, hydrophobic interactions here, a hydrogen bond there. So it's not merely the shape, it's also the nature of the interaction at the binding site improves the specificity dramatically and importantly. Just handedness is not enough, ladies and gentlemen. But oddly enough, it's sort of misnamed. This is stereospecific. This is called geometric specificity. It really doesn't provide much additional information when it talks about how the different additional information is available. It just is what it is. Good luck with that. All right, next. Cofactors and coenzymes. There are many, many enzymes that work all just fine by themselves, but there are also a significant group of enzymes that require additional materials that are not protein in nature. Can someone think of a disease that's dependent on a cofactor that you get in your diet? What is it? Scurvy. That's exactly correct. The enzyme requires vitamin C as a cofactor or coenzyme to act on hydroxylating that proline that's a part of production of collagen. So you define these things. Small molecules are ions that associate with enzymes required for their catalytic activity. Catalytic activity. Coenzymes typically have to be regenerated because they've been chemically modified during a reaction. You don't find that with ions. They're not chemically modified. Many are vitamins. Vitamins. Of course, we just talked about vitamin C, ascorbic acid. What other water-soluble vitamins are there? Let's see here. What other? Vitamin B, all the niacins and thiamines. Those are water-soluble vitamins, and those become coenzymes. Some are trace minerals. And let's get through this. Copper, iron, zinc, there's manganese, there's all kinds of them. Some only transiently associate with the enzymes called co-substrates. Right in co-substrates. Some are permanently bound. They still have to be regenerated. Those are called prosthetic group. Type in prosthetic groups. Catalytic active enzyme cofactors. If you have an enzyme that requires a cofactor, and it's all there, and it's all ready to go, and it's actively activating, and it's doing its business, and it's doing fine. That's called a holoenzyme. The entire enzyme is there, ready to go along with its cofactor. It's a complete. The inactive enzyme missing only the cofactor is called an apoenzyme. If it's just the protein without the cofactor, it's inactive. It's called apoenzyme. We'll look at these characteristics of common coenzymes on Friday. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.